welcome to Stories from the Hurricane Highway, the podcast. I am your host, Mark Suddeth. This is the episode dropping on March the 19th, 2020. And all I'm going to say is, wow. You know what, though? This is not about current events, so I'll just let that sigh speak for everything, the despair that's in my voice there, because this is all about the past. And as we take a look back down the hurricane highway in the rearview mirror, as it were, hey, that's a good way to put it. We're looking at the year 2004, and we're continuing on. This is part two, or part three, or whatever it is. It's getting to me. We're going to look at, and this will be fairly short, this episode here, this installment. We're going to take a look at some technology transitions and an idea that I had as we were progressing through the year 2004 after the tornado chasing that we did, myself and Jesse and John. And then we did that on Memorial Day weekend. The Day After Tomorrow movie was out, and then all of a sudden, it's summer. Once we got back from the Memorial Day weekend tornado chasing festival that we had in Kansas, it was basically summer, and certainly the start of hurricane season 2004. But as you know, the hurricane season really didn't get going until the end of July, and then it just kept going for about 6 weeks. And we know what happened after that. And we will get to that. But first, we're going to talk about the birth of something that really was the beginning of where we are now. And it really was. And that is the Hurricane Landfall Project. Just to kind of recap and set the stage, we had the Chevy Tahoe fully outfitted with weather equipment, the anemometer, the pressure sensor, had a video camera mounted on the roof, all kinds of stuff on the roof. It very much resembled a movie set piece, like out of the movie Twister. You know, it looked like something from Ghostbusters, you name it. And it served a very practical purpose. You know, I look back now and I realize it was probably overkill, because everything we do now is all remote. And, you know, even if Chevrolet or, you know, some very wealthy patron donated a vehicle, I wouldn't outfit it with a whole bunch of stuff because we don't need to anymore. But back then, you know, we did. We had to drive that thing into hurricanes to get the data. We just didn't have the setup that we do now. And so it was very well equipped to do so. However, we had the Isuzu that I had used since 1999, and we weren't just gonna, you know, I wasn't gonna just sell that or get rid of it or whatever. It was paid for. And so we decided to do something rather bold, and it really did lead to where we are now. I worked very closely with Jesse and John Van Pelt from the Storm Study Project, and my good friend and colleague Eddie Smith, and my good friend Dr. Brian Davis from University of North Carolina, Wilmington, my old astronomy physics professor. And when I say old, I mean like he used to be, not that he's old, even though he is older now, but you know what I'm saying. the group of us, we all kind of brainstormed, and we came up with this idea that we would somehow transform and make use of the Isuzu as sort of a crash test dummy for hurricanes. And my idea was to get it kind of retrofit with additional mounting points, you know, maybe some reinforcement and different places to put stuff, you know, to maybe some mount some camera units, these scuba housings. And I'll talk about this more in a moment, but I basically, I had this light bulb go off. I was like, why don't we set up the Isuzu kind of like they do when they test airplanes? And you've seen that old classic footage when they crash. I think it's like a DC-10 or something in the desert, and they have cameras inside, and they have dummies, and they show it in slow motion, and the explosion, and the destruction of the plane, and it's all for testing purposes and understanding aircraft, aerodynamics, engineering, you name it. They do the same, of course, with automobiles. Plenty of crash test video out there. And I thought, why don't we make the Isuzu our own virtual, you know, laboratory and literal laboratory, crash test hurricane dummy, if you will, and load it up with cameras. And I had to figure out how to do that. And also attach weather instruments to it. So I talked to several different people and companies to help me with this. The first was Edwards Incorporated here in New Hanover County in Wilmington, North Carolina, a crane company. They also do fabrication and other industrial-related things. Again, it's called Edwards Incorporated, Edwards Inc. And I went over and I met with, I guess, the project manager or the local branch manager, whatever he is, his title. His name was Jamie Ezell. I met with him, and I kind of toyed around with some different ideas. I said, you know, we want to get some things mounted on the Isuzu, welded to it, bolted to it, that we could mount things on, you know, and to get it ready, rigged up, if you will, to leave out in a hurricane and put equipment on it, and whatever happens, happens. Who cares? And so he was kind of like, yeah, that could be interesting. You know, it's kind of the opposite of what was happening in some people's minds about tornadoes. Remember, at some point in the mid-2000s, a couple of guys got this idea to armor and reinforce their vehicles and drive them into tornadoes, which I still don't understand. I mean, hurricanes are bad enough, but, you know, I wanted to kind of, you know, as 180 degrees for me, I wanted to leave the vehicle and let it be the crash test dummy, not me. You know, I wasn't going to be the dummy. I didn't, and Jesse and John and Eddie, no. So, met with Jamie Ezell, we came up with some ideas and a few designs, you know, probably in Photoshop or something, and tossed it around and, you know, kind of put it on the back burner. And then I talked to a company out in Nevada, I believe it was Reno, that that made scuba diving housings. I had ordered one from them way back in 1999, 2000, somewhere around there, that I used in Hurricane Gordon. If you remember in the year 2000 episode, I talked about that I had this camera housing. It's like a scuba diving housing without the electronics that comes with it. It was just the shell. And, you know, we didn't have GoPros back then. And so I wanted my video camera, my Sony digital video camera, to be protected so I could shoot hurricane video outside of whatever vehicle I was in without the camera getting wet. You know, duh. It was like I needed to solve that problem. And so they sent me this camera housing, which, by the way, I still have that. It's in my garage. I ought to auction that off or something someday, or give it to the year's top patron or something. That's a good point. But I just thought of that. I actually still have that, believe it or not. I really do. In fact, I'll post a picture of it as a link when I post this onto Patreon, so you can at least see it. You'll see what I'm talking about. Anyhow, got in touch with this company in 2004, and yeah, you remember me? And, oh yeah, okay. And you know, the crazy guy wanting to film hurricanes with, you know. And I said, can you make me maybe a smaller version and build them custom for me, where all it is literally the shell, this protective fiberglass or whatever the heck they're made out of, that has the special acrylic lens or opening in the front. It's not glass, but maybe it is. But, you know, just custom make me four of them with no electronics in them at all. Because the electronics is what you would hook up your high-end, like Jacques Cousteau, National Geographic BBC underwater filming mechanism, you know, your $10,000 video camera, or probably more than that, you would hook this up through a bunch of different wires and connectors so that you could control stop, start, focus, zoom, you name it, from the edges of these housings, see? And I didn't need all that. I just needed the protective case, like what you get now with a GoPro. Looks like something came out of a Cracker Jack box, doesn't it? It does. And the company said, yeah, and they gave them to me at a very reasonable cost. I think it was like $300 total for all four of them. And then I bought four Hi8 Sony video cameras off of probably Outpost.com or somebody back then. I don't think I was ordering from B&H Photo just yet, but who knows? I love the B&H. That was how we were going to do it. The vehicle would have cameras on top and then maybe one inside, again, to film a hurricane's wrath from the vehicle. And we would stick the vehicle on the beachfront somewhere, not like right out on the beach like that red Jeep during Hurricane Dorian or whatever it was. I don't mean sitting right on the sand, but you know, you leave the vehicle behind, maybe anchor it down, and you have the anemometer and all this kind of stuff. Kind of like what we got now, but in an SUV. That was the idea. So, that was what I wanted to do. And it slowly took shape. And so, I worked with John, and his marketing skills were excellent. Like I said, he got us that mobile threat net stuff from Barron Weather Services. And he got in touch with Pelican and the Stormcase people. That's the brand name. Pelican, you know, I don't know. Maybe I know Pelican bought Stormcase. I think Stormcase was from Hardig, H-A-R-D-I-G-G. And I think Pelican bought them a number of years ago. But anyhow, John got in touch with the Stormcase folks. Stormcase was literally the brand name for these military spec cases that the military, obviously, photographers, film people, you know, anything you needed to move, airline, ship, whatever, with a protective hard case, Hardig and Pelican were the go-to sources. In fact, some of these Pelican cases, or the Storm cases, were so popular that I remember seeing one of the ones that we actually used in those early days on that hit show on Fox, 24. Remember that about Jack Bauer? Kind of a, you know, what we know now as they got that Jack Ryan with John Krasinski or whatever his name is, the guy from The Office. Well, Jack Bauer, of course, Kiefer Sutherland. And I remember they actually had a Pelican, or I keep saying Pelican, it was a Storm case in one of the episodes of 24 and whatever. So John got his hands on some of those. The Hardig Corporation donated them. And we started working on it. And I got my really good friend that I had grown up with in New Bern. His name is Jason. We grew up together. He was a science guy. I was too, weather geek, you name it. He was computers and math. And he had a degree at this point. This is 2004. And so he has a degree in computer engineering or computer science or something. And I believe he had a master's at this point from University of Washington. You'd think if he's my best friend and ended up being the best man at my wedding that I would know these details, but I don't, but I do know that he is a programmer, and that's what matters here, okay? And he worked for SAS Institute in Cary, North Carolina, still does, a statistical analysis company. SAS means statistical analysis software. And so, you know, I talked to him. I said, all right, so we got these Armyoung anemometers that we're using. I had two of them at this point, the one from the Isuzu back in the day, and then we had one for the Chevy Tahoe. And I said, can we come up with a way for you to talk to, I need you to write a program basically in Windows, you know, for a Windows laptop that can talk to the Arm Young anemometer and the Davis pressure sensor. It's actually a Davis weather monitor too, the little console. Because the Arm Young stuff is extremely expensive, still is. And so we had an Arm Young anemometer, which was like the one we were using back then was about $800. And the Davis console was like $200 or something. And it had temperature, pressure, humidity. And anyway, we wanted high-end wind data. And the Davis console was very reliable for pressure. You know, it had enough of an accuracy that it was very good. And so basically, I said, can you create a program for us to talk to those instruments, log the data, create averages, etc., and then pump it out to our website where we can display it in an interface on a web page, live weather data, and integrate our webcam that we're doing. Remember, we were working with Sprint since 2001, and now we were able to send a webcam image to the website every minute or so. And we thought we were pretty in the game here. You know, this is pretty high tech stuff for 2004. And in fact, the webcam image, we could do it up to I think it was like 360 by 240. Pretty good. You know, we're getting closer to 640 by 480. So that's what I did. I went to Jason. I need you to write a program that'll collect all this stuff, the webcam image, the wind data, the pressure data, and display it on a web page for us that we can put on hurricanetrack.com. Can you do that? And he said, okay, I'll see what I can do. And he did. And so we worked on that during the summer. I would take him equipment. He lives up in the Raleigh area of North Carolina. And that's what we did all during the early part of 2004 in the hurricane season, waiting for hurricanes. We did the Lowe's hurricane fairs as well, all around the country. John and I would go to some, Jesse and I would go to some, Mike Farrow and I would go to some. You know, it was business as usual, and a lot of people were really paying attention to the world of hurricanes. It was, really the beginning of 3G. Everybody was getting, close to having smartphones. We had color screens on our Sanyo bar phones, our Samsungs. We were still three years away from the first iPhone, but we're getting there. You can send pictures. You can send little crappy videos from your iPhone, from your bar phone. Because you had flip phones, looked like a clam. You'd flip it open, right? They use those like in Breaking Bad. If you've watched that series, they're just all about that. I guess flip phones make for good burner phones. But and then you had these bar phones, which is like a solid, one looks like a bar. That's what they call them. And I had a Sanyo, and I remember it had a color screen, and then you could take little horrible videos, like 15-second videos that just looked terrible, and you could take pictures. So we worked on all this, and we're, waiting for the hurricanes. When are we going to have a hurricane? And so that was, the good side of all this, that the season took so long to get going, is that we had plenty of time to put all this stuff together. We did. So there we were. We worked on it. John would come down and help me in Wilmington. I would drive up to Raleigh. Jesse and I would spend hours talking on the phone, speculating on how we could do this. What if we do that? And just, I would do testing of equipment. I remember I went to Sam's Club. This is a great story here. I went to Sam's Club. In fact, this is why and it just occurred to me now, I talked about this, that I will remember things even as I go along, and the storyline will get interrupted as I remember a detail. And this is one of those times. We had all this equipment. I think Jason was, close to finishing. This is probably sometime in July. He was close to finishing the program, and we needed a place to store the laptop, the data logger, the battery, the big AGM marine battery that would power all this stuff, the wires, the inverter, you know, the electronics. Where are you going to keep all this? In the Isuzu. You know, because you got to protect it, because water is going to come in. We're going to leave it at the, you know, in the ocean front, so to speak. And surge is going to come in, and, you know, we got to have it last as long as possible. And we got to protect that equipment. And so I had the, you know, I was on the phone with John. I remember I was on the phone. I'm like, why don't I go to Sam's and buy one of those big coolers? And you seal that up, and they're supposed to be, you know, not airtight, but, I mean, I guess enough so that that should protect everything, right? And then we could use the valve that they have on the cooler to let all the water out when your ice melts to run the wires into. And then we use this putty stuff to kind of seal it off, you know, and make it as protected as possible from any water that gets into the Isuzu. And he's like, yeah, it's a good idea. So I ran over to Sam's. And, you know, you got to remember to brag a little bit. I had all the funding I could possibly want from Lowe's and Sprint, you know, and you know, we didn't waste any money, but I had plenty of R&D money. It was great. You know, not $1 million or anything. Don't think it was that crazy, but, you know, we could test things, and if they didn't work, it was not a total like, oh man, we're out of money. What are we going to do? We were well funded, and so that was a plus. So I ran to Sam's and I bought a big old blue and white cooler. I don't know. It's just one of those giant party coolers, plastic, you know, like a real nice one. I don't remember who made it. Doesn't matter. Not a styrofoam cooler, obviously, but a big, like you're going to put it out and go tailgating with it. You're going to bring it to the picnic and fill it with ice and throw, you know, 40 cans of soda and beer in there. And I lived at the time in a neighborhood that had two pools. You know, like a fitness center recreation area. It's called Magnolia Greens. And I took the cooler, drove it over to the pole. You had to have this key fob to get in, and they got security cameras there and, you know, whatever, right? So this is great. This is so funny. I took a piece of paper towel or toilet paper or something, and back when those things existed readily available, years from now, when someone listens to this podcast, they're going to go, what did he mean by that? Oh, anyhow, I put some, I think it was Bounty, like a sheet of Bounty towel at the bottom of the cooler, because that was going to be my test. If the towel wasn't wet, because Bounty paper towels are very good at wicking up moisture, if it wasn't wet, the one sheet, then my test worked. And what was my test going to be? My genius idea was to put the cooler in the pool. Just put it in the pool. Don't throw it in. Just slide it in the pool. It'll float out. And then I would jump on top of it and try to submerge it. You know, put all my weight on it. I probably weighed 180, 185 back then. This is before I started getting real heavy and all that. You know, I was working on it. And that's big enough. Okay, I can sink that sucker and, you know, stand on top of it in the shallow end of the pool and maybe for 5 minutes and see if it sprung a leak. You know, open it up after I'm done, take it out and see if the paper towel was wet. This was my genius idea. It's too bad that there's no way I could have gotten the surveillance video from the pool, from the fitness center there. So I put the cooler, and you know where this is going. I put the cooler in the pool, and it kind of listed over to one side. You know, it's not perfectly balanced or whatever, so it lists over. That's what they call that. A ship will list back and forth, right? So it lists over to kind of one side, and it floats away. It's floating away. There's nobody out there. It's just me. It's probably 9:30 at night in the middle of the summer. And I look around, there's nobody around. I'm like, all right, got my bathing suit on. And I jump on top of it, not like a cannonball or something dumb. I just kind of jumped out on it. And I tell you what, the fact that I'm here today is a miracle. Because that thing, like, shot out from under me. I went under, and it went up into the air. And as I came up, the cooler fell, and it landed in the water just millimeters from my noggin. And had it bonked me on the head, it probably would have knocked me out and I would have drowned. True story. I mean, absolutely just a, okay. I mean, it was just like, thank goodness nobody was around to see that. And I thought, one day I'll tell this story in a podcast episode. No, just kidding. But it really was like, whew, okay, well, that didn't work. So I dragged it over to the shallow end, like the where the little kids can go. And I sat on it, and it was very, very difficult because of its buoyancy with even my 180, 185 pounds to get it to sink. I finally got it to do so. And yes, it got water in it, and it wasn't going to work, you know, because it wasn't designed. I understand that there's a certain industry standard for how waterproof something is. You know, we know about that now more than ever with our work going forward, but I didn't know it back then. It was all trial and error. So, hey, guess what? We had a cooler if we ever needed it. I told John, yep, didn't work. The towel got wet. You know, it didn't fill up the cooler, but this probably isn't going to work. We need to come up with something else. And then I said, and this is where this happened, hey, you know those Pelican kicks? I keep saying Pelican, because it is Pelican now, Pelican Bottom, like I said. I said, you know those storm cases we're using, those little ones? Because John had gotten us like a briefcase size one. I still have that even to this day. I said, you know, don't they make like a real big version of that? Kind of like a big cooler? And they are, whatever that protocol is for, you know, water tightness, right? A certain water, you know, resistance to a certain depth for a certain amount of time. The IP value, or there's some value for that. I can't remember what it is. ISO, I think, is what it's called. And he was like, oh, yeah, duh. Yeah, that's a great idea. And so he got in touch with Hartig, and that's how we got the big storm cases. And they sent us several of them, and we were ready. And so that's what happened. And we're getting towards the end of July. No tropical activity to speak of. Just a few, you know, random things here and there. Tropical wave might develop. Whatever. I'm blogging about it on the website at hurricanetrack.com. Or what we now know as blogging. And we had this other really big idea that we were going to do starting in 2004. We decided that it was time to start moving towards live coverage. We couldn't quite do it yet. The bandwidth wasn't there. The technology wasn't there just yet. If it was there, we weren't aware of it. I'll just say that. But we did want to at least do the next best thing, and that was to start recording what are called look lives in the business. One of those, we call them video updates. That's actually what we call them. You know, where you set the camera, somebody holds it, whatever, and you do a, hey, good evening, everybody. Mark Suddeth here, and I'm on the Outer Banks. It's 7 p.m., and you tell people who, what, when, where, why, couple minutes, whatever, and you upload that. And remember, we don't have YouTube like we do now. I think YouTube just started out that year. And it was extremely cumbersome to do this. You know, you had to record it on a digital video camera, what's called a DV cam, capture it on a laptop with a FireWire cable, digitize it to your laptop, then save it, maybe in a program to compress it down to probably 320 by 240 or something like that, the video size. Get the bitrate low enough, you know, the bandwidth, the file size, and then use FTP, which is File Transport Protocol, to upload that to my server, and then I got to go to my webpage and put a link to it. And then there's no way to tell everybody. You know, you have to just, like now, of course, you can just do everything live, but now, if you post something on Twitter, and, you know, like me, you got 30 plus thousand people following you, you know, a certain amount of people that are constantly engaged, they know about it. They get notified or whatever. There's no way to do that. You could say, well, you could have had an email marketing campaign, but, you know, that's the problem. Back then, you did all this, and it would take like 45 minutes just to get a 90-second clip on my website. But we were bound and determined to do that. And in fact, the very first video update that we did in the field, if you will, was from one of the Lowe's Hurricane Fairs in Virginia Beach, Virginia. John and Jesse and I, all three were there, and we used it as an opportunity to like make history. And it's out there somewhere in the ether of the internet. That video is out there somewhere. The very first one where we were like, hey, good afternoon, everybody. Mark Seddeth here. And I'm John Van Pelt. Hey, I'm Jesse Bass. And we're here in Virginia Beach and blah, 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 blah. That was done in the early summer of 2004. And we posted that like 45 minutes later to the website. And we wanted to do that during hurricanes. These quick clips that we could post online, even if we just did two or three throughout the entire hurricane, you know, we felt like that would be a big leap forward. And so we were ready for that. And I mean, we were armed. We were, you know, loaded for bear, as they say, for the 2004 hurricane season, and we were just waiting for something to happen. So there we were, ready to go. It's now the end of July, and the Isuzu was progressing. We weren't quite ready yet. We had taken it to Edwards. They began the fabrication to add some things to it, some reinforcements up on the rooftop inside, this platform on the top, and whatever. You know, the process began at the very end of July, like the last third of July of 2004. And the program was done from Jason. He wrote an interface on the website. We called it HIRT-WIND, H-I-R-T, for Hurricane Intercept Research Team. That was our group name. And the wind, you know, it's like Project So-and-So, whatever. This was HIRT-WIND. It was the wind program primarily, because wind data to me was the most important aspect of what I wanted to collect. And as I've learned over the years, the pressure data is at least as important. And in some circles, pressure data might be even more important. But we'll address that on a later date. But everything was ready. The interface was there. The webcam was embedded into the page. It was this beautiful interface, this, you know, graphical user interface or GUI web interface that people could go to at hurricanetrack.com and see everything. And it was almost live. You know, the weather data would update every minute. The webcam would update every minute with an image. I mean, that was pretty darn good for 2004. And we were at least one of the only people to have it, if not the only people to have it, especially something that was publicly available. Now you have Weatherflow and the Weather Underground and Earthcams and you name it, it's out there. But back then, this was big, and it was purposefully set up for hurricane observation and research. And it would take the place of us having to be there once it was ready. And that's where I will end this episode, once it was ready. That was the key. It's got to be ready before you can deploy it. And so, you know, the question was, would time run out and we get a hurricane before the Hurricane Landfall Project and its vehicle, the debut of the HLP, Hurricane Landfall Project, Isuzu Rodeo, sacrificed to the hurricane gods vehicle, would it be ready in time for the first hurricane and beyond? And that's where I'll leave the cliffhanger for you. You'll have to tune in next week to find out. All right? So there you go. We're all the way up now. Hopefully the anticipation is just killing you. And from here, of course, we jump into the hurricanes, the big onslaught that began at the very end of July and wouldn't end until the end of September in terms of landfalls, and then they kept going after that just out in the Atlantic. But we will get to all of that, and that's what I'm going to do over these next several weeks, as we close out season one of Stories from the Hurricane Highway. We will be focused on the rest of 2004, and that'll get us into, the remainder of March into April, through April, and then the first part of May. I'll have a an ending final episode that kind of ties everything together and what to look forward to when we start this up again in December. So, that's the plan. That's what we're going to do. This will be in the off season, as I've mentioned before, a December through May podcast series exclusively for the most awesome people in the world, and that is the people that support this project currently and as long as far back as 15, 16 years ago. And some of you, yes, have been with me for that long. You're the ones that make this possible. And so this is my gift to you. So thank you so much. All right. Well, that'll wrap it up for this edition and this journey, these few miles down the Hurricane Highway. This has been Stories from the Hurricane Highway. I am Mark Suddeth for HurricaneTrack.com. As always, thank you so much for tuning into this. I'll have another one as we look into what happened once the hurricanes began next week.